I'm Chris Sims.
And I'm Todd McKay.
This is the Canadian Taxpayers Podcast. We're dedicated to lower taxes, less waste, and more accountable government. In this episode, we'll take a deep dive into the Trudeau government's gun buyback program and our push to fight back in court. And in Waste Watch, we'll tell you about the City of Ottawa wasting taxpayers' money on scented air fresheners while trying to cover up the stench of a ruptured sewer pipe on their underground light rail line.
Yeah, that didn't go well. Anytime you clip a sewer line, it's not good, but the plan to fix it there. Anyway, we need to talk about a big moment in Canadian energy right now. Obviously, the sector is having trouble. But here's something that'll perk you up. Alberta Oil is on its way to the Irvine Refinery in New Brunswick. But here's the catch. It's going through the Panama Canal.
That's right. A big tanker just finished filling up at the Trans Mountain Terminal in Burnaby, out here on the West Coast. The company Cenovus Energy sent out a tweet, quote, "We've sold our first crude oil shipment to Irving Oil. The tanker Cabo de Hornos is now on a voyage of 11,900 kilometers to the Irving St. John, New Brunswick refinery via the Panama Canal after loading at Trans Mountain Burnaby, BC Terminal!" Exclamation mark.
You know, I took a geography class in university. That was a while ago. It probably wasn't my best class, but here's what I do know. Is the fastest way to get from Alberta to New Brunswick does not go through Panama. It's about, 4,400 Ks from Edmonton to St. John. And they're going almost 12,000 Ks going through Panama. It's almost three times the distance. And of course, they're burning diesel the whole way. If only there was an easier way to get energy to the east. Energy to the east. Energy east. Yeah, the Energy East pipeline would have done exactly this. It would have taken oil from Alberta, put it through a pipeline straight to New Brunswick. It would have stayed under Canadian control the whole way. We could have had our standards over it. Instead, we're filling tankers on the West Coast, running it all the way down the West Coast, through the Panama Canal, all the way up the East Coast to New Brunswick. It's hard to imagine a dumber plan than this.
It really is. It's nonsensical. But while many sensible people have pointed out that this is really crazy and that strangling pipeline building in Canada is a bad idea, we've actually gone the extra mile at the Taxpayers Federation to point this out. Last summer, we added up how much Canada has lost out in just federal taxes, 2013 to 2023, by strangling pipelines and not having them. It's close to $13 billion in just 10 years. So those lost billions, they could instead buy six brand new St. Paul's hospitals in Vancouver, or $13 billion, it could exempt the entire population of Kamloops from federal taxes for 17 years.
I could just hear the folks in Kamloops. Let's do that. That sounds good. No federal taxes for 17 years. Well, that's why we need to build pipelines. It's a huge mistake from both an energy perspective and a jobs perspective to block all of these pipeline projects. But it's also a big mistake from a tax and revenue perspective. So we did that calculation over that span from 2013 to 2023. So that goes into the future, about $13 billion in losses to taxpayers. So we took that message across Canada. We got some big inflatable oil barrels that showed really clearly the price that we get when we can't move our oil and what we could be getting on the world market. Spoiler alert, we could get a lot more if we had pipelines. We also put a big digital display and it had numbers running up in real time. They were running really fast and they showed people how much money we were losing in real time because we couldn't get a fair price for our oil. But here's the thing, we didn't just take this to Red Deer and Lloydminster and places like that in the West. We took it to the lawn on Parliament Hill. There was a protest going on, but we took that message right there. We took it to Montreal. We took it to Halifax. We took it to Victoria. We held press conferences to show Canadians how much money we're losing in real time because we can't get pipelines built.
Now, we did get some good news that we need to share on the energy front. The Supreme Court of Canada has refused to hear the latest challenge to the Trans Mountain pipeline. That means that the Court of Appeals decision stands and that the work to twin that line will continue. That's the pipeline that currently runs from Edmonton out to the Trans Mountain Terminal in Burnaby here in British Columbia. And I can actually see that work is slowly rolling ahead every time I drive down the Fraser Valley in BC. It is happening.
Yeah, and we're going to keep pushing for that here at the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. All of us have to pay more taxes because we can't get a fair price for our oil and for our gas. We need to get these projects built. We need to have those high standards in terms of safety and environmental standards. We got to be able to get this work done. Otherwise, we're doing things like shipping oil from Alberta to New Brunswick through the Panama Canal.
Coming up next, Todd's going to take a deep dive into taking the Trudeau government to court to fight the gun buyback program. We're getting an update from our federal director, Aaron Woodrick.
It's time for our deep dive. This is when we get deeper into important issues. And our federal director, Aaron Woodrick, he's joining us today because he's got an important announcement to let us know about.
Yeah, it's a good one, Todd. It's a big announcement. The Canadian Taxpayers Federation is joining the court fight against the Trudeau government's gun ban and buyback policy.
Yeah, and that's an important fight. The Canadian Taxpayers Federation supporters, man, they're energized about this issue. So when the Trudeau government first announced that it's banning thousands of guns and spending hundreds of millions of dollars to buy them back from licensed gun owners, We surveyed our supporters. We asked them, hey, what do you think of this? More than 90% came back saying they're opposed to this policy. They recognize that criminals, they get their guns illegally. They smuggle them from the States. And they also recognized that there are much better ways to make Canada safer than spending hundreds of millions of dollars taking guns away from licensed gun owners. We've had thousands of Canadians signing our petition against this policy. Then we sent out an email. We said, hey, listen, if we take this to court, would you mind chipping in to help on the legal bills? And the response was immediate. Our supporters were there. So we're going to go to court. We're going to try to stop this this policy. We're going to make arguments against it. Aaron, tell us a little bit about what we're getting into.
So the main case, Todd, is actually being launched by a woman named Cassandra Parker. She owns a gun store in northern BC. And the gun ban and buyback is obviously devastating for her personally and her business. You know, the ban makes it illegal to sell a lot of guns, but the Trudeau government also doesn't have any real firm or clear plans to implement the buyback part of the policy. So she's effectively stuck with an inventory that she can't sell. So she's filing an application, she's taking it to the court, and we at the CTF are applying to intervene in the case, which means we're asking for the opportunity to join the case and make arguments from the taxpayer point of view that we think are important for the court to hear. And of course, we have a history of doing this in a number of cases, including most recently on things like carbon tax.
So there's a number of groups getting into this case. And I think it's fair to say that Ms. Parker, she's going to need all the help she can get, because over at the Department of Justice in Ottawa, they've got office buildings full of lawyers that'll be jumping into this one. Now, I do want to get to the legal arguments that are coming out of this case. Conveniently, Aaron, you're a recovering lawyer, and you're not all the way recovered yet, so you can explain some of these things. Let us know what some of the legal points are here.
Yeah, well, obviously, it makes sense that Ms. Parker's concerned about the ban, since it could put her out of business. But the problems with the law actually go a lot further. And in her legal filing, she makes a couple of arguments, including that the gun ban and buyback is, quote, unreasonable, arbitrary, and unsupported by the evidence, and also that it, quote, infringes on the right to enjoyment of property.
That's interesting, because we don't often hear about any requirements for laws to be reasonable, and we don't often hear about property rights in Canada. So let's break those apart and go through them one at a time. What's going on with the reasonable requirement? Tell us about that.
Well, Todd, there's a branch of law that's called administrative law, and that basically governs whether decision-making bodies like courts and tribunals and governments as well follow the right process and procedures and make decisions that are reasonable. And one of Cassandra Parker's arguments is that the decision in this case that the Trudeau government made, based on the evidence, actually isn't reasonable. And I'll give you an analogy. Some of you might remember a toy called lawn darts. There are these very heavy darts that you could throw way up in the air and they land on your lawn. There was a tragedy somewhere, I believe it was in the States, and someone was killed by one of these. So the government's decided to ban lawn darts. Now, when they did that, they didn't ban every kind of dart. They only banned the lawn darts because those were the ones that had this incident and people were worried about, and there was a you know, an example of the risk. And so if come back to the guns again, in this case, the Trudeau government is banning all kinds of guns, thousands of models of guns, without any evidence that they're actually more dangerous than other guns. And under administrative law, that can be a big no-no.
Yeah, government lawyers are going to have a tough time, it seems to me, on the other side of this issue. So fully automatic guns, guns that keep firing when you hold the trigger down, they've been banned in Canada since the late 1970s. It's pretty easy to draw that line. If you can hold the trigger down and it fires automatically, fully automatic, it's banned. And I don't really think there's a lot of argument about that in Canada. But now the Trudeau government is banning some guns and not others with no particular explanation. I'll give you an example. A lot of farmers and ranchers, they use a gun called a Ruger Mini 14. Ottawa's banning that gun, but it's not banning another gun called an SKS, even though it operates very similarly. It's the same principle, same basic operation. In fact, the SKS actually fires bigger, heavier bullets. So it's going to be really hard for the Trudeau government to justify why it's banning some guns and not others. It'll be hard for the government to bring evidence to support its ban. Now, Aaron, you also mentioned property rights, but property rights aren't included in Canada's Charter of Rights and Freedom. So explain how that enters the debate.
Well, you're right, Todd. They're not, property rights are not in the Charter, but they actually are in the Canadian Bill of Rights.
The Bill of Rights. That sounds American. I think you're going to have to remind people about the Canadian Bill of Rights.
Yeah, so it's actually a bill that was brought in by Prime Minister John Diefenbaker, who passed this law well before Pierre Trudeau implemented the Charter. And we don't hear a lot about the Bill of Rights anymore because it's been overshadowed by the Charter, which ended up covering a lot of the same types of rights. But if you want to think of the Charter as like being new wallpaper that was put up over the Bill of Rights, which was the old wallpaper, there's actually some spots that weren't covered. And so you can still see the old wallpaper, and that wallpaper is still the law of the land, the Bill of Rights. So, and the Bill of Rights includes in Section 1A, the right of the individual to life, liberty, security of person, and enjoyment of property.
I'm guessing most Canadians didn't know about that. It's good to know that property rights are an important right in Canada, because property rights are really important.
They really are. And it's unfortunate that property rights are often framed as an American-only thing. But thanks to the Bill of Rights, we do have statutory protection of property in this country, specifically that you have a right to enjoy your property. And in this case, you know, Cassandra Parker is arguing that the government went way too far in banning way too many guns. Governments do have the right to limit certain rights, but they need to provide a justification for it. And those limits need to be minimal. So I'll give you an example. We have a pretty robust freedom of speech in this country, believe it or not, but there are obvious things that are not allowed, such as libel and slander. So you can't accuse someone, you can't say that someone has murdered somebody else if it's not true, because of course that could do a lot of damage to their reputation. And it's limited to things like fact. You can call someone a mean name, but you cannot say something about them that's just factually wrong. So going back to the guns though, the government is just, they're not just banning a specific gun for a specific reason. They're just arbitrarily banning thousands of guns with no evidence and without even trying to minimize the limitation on property.
So those are the overarching points in the case as it's going forward. But tell us where the Canadian Taxpayers Federation fits in on this.
Well, the obvious angle for us is the cost. During the election, the Liberals had talked about a buyback program, and they had estimated that program would only cost about $200 million. But for people who are old enough to remember, the Liberals once created a gun registry. The price tag was only supposed to be $2 million. And in reality, it ended up costing over $1 billion. So a slight cost overrun, to say the least. So you can appreciate that we're a little bit skeptical when it comes to governments estimating costs when it comes to guns.
Yeah, that $1 billion gun boondoggle, that's probably one the Liberal government would prefer to forget about. And speaking of more reliable estimates on the gun buyback, I was just talking to our friend Jordan Williams on the podcast a few weeks ago. He's the executive director of the New Zealand Taxpayers Union. And of course, New Zealand has very recent experience with banning guns and buying them back. They had cost overruns. And here's Jordan talking a little bit about that.
Back of the envelope, assuming the scope of the bans are about the same as ours, because that's the real issue. It's not the number of firearms owners, it's the number of firearms that are banned. And assuming that we've got about 250,000 firearms, licensed firearms owners here, but I'd be very surprised if Canada gets away with it costing $2 billion. But the thing is, go back to my point earlier, we did it on the cheap. If you want it to actually be successful, you probably want to pay $3 billion. And then the question is that $3 billion worth it for what you get in return?
So that was Jordan Williams from the New Zealand Taxpayers Union. He's ballparking the costs in Canada for a buyback at $2 billion. Hopefully, he's on the high end of it, but I think it's a pretty good bet that it's going to come in over $200 million that the government is sort of ballparking for this.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say the government has generally lowballed their estimates on these things. And obviously, preventing the kind of crazy cost overrun is right in our wheelhouse at the CTF. Now, the tricky part from a legal standpoint is that wasteful spending isn't really a legal argument. If we had to go to court every time there was wasteful spending, we'd probably have to just be a full-time law firm and we'd be in court every day. But the spending part is connected to the reasonableness of the law. And that's where I think there's a legal angle that we can bring forward.
So basically, we can't go to court just to complain about wasteful spending, but we can go to court and make strong arguments that a decision that's leading to wasteful spending is unreasonable.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, we are still working with our external lawyers to hash out some of the finer points, and we hope to be following our arguments soon. But because we're seeking to intervene in the case, which means we're basically just asking the court to let us in, we have to convince the court first that what we have to say will be useful to them. So it's kind of like being pre-screened before we can formally participate in the case.
Yeah, and it's always a little bit hard to know what'll happen in the court process. But listen, we've got great lawyers working on this. We're watching other cases as well. We're looking at those. And so overall, we're feeling pretty good about our chances here. I think we can make a real difference on this issue.
You know, I think so. And the CTF has a great track record in court. Just in December, we intervened at the Supreme Court to argue that judges shouldn't get automatic raises when governments are trying to keep a lid on spending across government. We're, of course, the only non-government organization that's intervened to argue against the Trudeau carbon tax. We've done that in Ontario and Saskatchewan and Alberta, including a win at the Alberta Court of Appeal. And that one is going to the big final for all the marbles at the Supreme Court in the fall, and we'll be there again arguing against the carbon tax. And, you know, while there's no sure bets at court, we're confident that we can make a difference in this fight against that terrible Trudeau government gun ban and buyback.
So stay tuned on this, folks. Check out taxpayer.com. We've got a petition up there. If you haven't signed it, make sure you sign that. If you want updates about the court battle, you know, check there as well. And stay tuned. I'm pretty sure we'll have more about this in the coming weeks.
Hi, I'm Scott Hennig, president of the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. Sorry for interrupting the podcast, but I wanted to take a few seconds of your time to tell you more about the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. We are 235,000 Canadians from coast to coast that are fed up. We are fed up with politicians taking too much out of our paychecks, often to waste it on a bunch of pet projects, corporate welfare, and pork barreling to buy votes. We organize campaigns to push back on these politicians. These campaigns often include petition drives, billboards, media stunts, and more. But most importantly, they ask our supporters to pitch in and take action. Alone, we're a voice in the wilderness. Together, we're an army to be reckoned with. You can join the fight and sign up at no cost at taxpayer.com. That website again is taxpayer.com. Okay, now back to the podcast.
It's time for Waste Watch. This is when we make fun of dumb things the governments are spending your money on. And today we got somebody new on the show. We've talked about James Wood a lot. He's our investigative reporter, but it's starting to feel like he's kind of like Snuffleupagus. Like we keep talking about him and you never hear from him.
So today, we're bringing James himself on the show. James, what'd you dig up?
Well, let me start things off with a clip.
The trains aren't working properly. They're not reliable, let's be honest. I think that's being generous. And then when you are on the train, you have to go through a tunnel that smells first like rotten eggs, and it hits you the second you get into the tunnel, and it wafts into the train even before the doors open. Just kind of want to die. The next station smells like poop. So now you've got rotten eggs and poop. I'm just saying, that's not the optimum rider experience.
So that was Sarah Wright Gilbert, and she's a citizen member of Ottawa's Transit Commission.
Kind of sounds like somebody needs to fix a very smelly problem at that train station.
Yeah, it's a big problem. So during construction of the Capital's new transit line, they built a big tunnel for the downtown core. And during construction of that tunnel, a sewer line close to Parliament Station, which is the station basically right next to Parliament Hill, got clipped in some way, shape, or form. And there's been a horrible stench in that station ever since it got rolling, ever since it opened up late last year. They've been trying to get that smell fixed for months. And in the meantime, while trying to get that smell fixed, they put in $600 worth of air fresheners at Parliament Station to try to mask things a little bit.
Doesn't sound like a great solution. That kind of reminds me of college. You know, when the dorm room doesn't smell that good, probably should do some sock laundry, but instead, you know, just spray some Febreze around, see if that helps. Didn't generally work in college. How's it working here?
Well, it basically didn't work at all. According to documents that we dug up through Freedom of Information, the city had the air fresheners removed almost immediately after they went in.
Wait a second. That's actually almost dumber than the college plan. In college, you put the air freshener in, you don't take it back out again. Why in the world did the city of Ottawa spend $600 on air fresheners to cover up an overwhelming sewer stink and then take them back out again?
It's a good question. So it turns out that the air fresheners, they broke the city's own rules about scent sensitivities. Right after the city put up the fresheners, it started getting complaints from people who've had reactions to the scent, so they had to take them right out again.
So the city didn't know its own rules?
No, and it's a good question as to how people at City Hall didn't talk to one another, because they had the exact same problem and the exact same chain of events play out just a month earlier at a different station. They had put in air fresheners and they got a complaint. They had to take them out again. It was literally the exact same process. But there's a bigger problem here. It's the city of Ottawa has spent more than $2 billion on this light rail transit project, which has been plagued with delays and cost overruns. Here's what Ms. Wright Gilbert had to say about that.
Sure, this is a small thing. Fair, right? Like, it's a small thing, and you know, I don't want to belabor the point, but if this kind of ineffectiveness when it comes to decision making is so scattered, haphazard, and with no foresight or oversight is done on something this small, what the hell is happening with the rest of the line?
So it's not a good sign when the city tries to cover up the smell of a sewage leak with air fresheners. And then it has to take those air fresheners out because they break rules about scent sensitivities. Listen, I live in Moose Jaw. I can't smell this. My property taxes don't pay for this. Explain why I should care.
Well, that's the thing. Your taxes did go to this. This came up when I was talking to Ms. Ray Gilbert, and she put it really well. You can listen to this.
The amount of taxpayer money that was put into this, keeping in mind, if you live in Ottawa, you've paid for this train three times over. You paid for it in your municipal taxes, you've paid for it in your provincial taxes, and you paid for it in your federal taxes. And the same point could be made for everyone across the country. Their federal tax money went into this. So I paid for it, you and I have paid for it three times over, and we're still paying for it. But, you know, across this country, tax dollars have been put into the system. I don't disagree with there being, you know, federal and provincial funding. I think it absolutely makes sense. And so I'm not debating that point. But everyone should care about this system, whether they use it or not, because they're paying for it.
And we've got more links about this to the story that James wrote up. He's got way more documents in there. It's also on taxpayer.com. Check it out.
Thanks for listening to the Canadian Taxpayers Podcast. We hope you like the show. I gotta say, that story about the LRT in Ottawa is disgusting. Kudos to James Wood for flushing out those details.
Ah, flushing out the details. I see what you did there. You know, James Wood also edits the podcast. We're going to see if he leaves that joke in there. See if James found it funny. Thanks to him for doing that editing and for digging up all of those details. That was great work by James Wood. Check out the show notes for more information about all of the stories on this podcast. And please, subscribe to the show. Don't just listen here or there. Hit that subscribe button. Let's get to know each other, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Hi, I'm Scott Hennig, president of the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. If you've got another minute, I'd like to ask you to think about the one person you know that would really enjoy listening to this podcast. Do us a favor and do them a favor and send them a quick note to let them know about it. At the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, we believe there is power in numbers. That's why we've worked so hard to build an army of taxpayers who are ready to push back. And we did it because people like you shared our work with that one person that they knew would really appreciate taking part. Thanks for listening, and thanks for doing your part to make Canada a better place.